This is History 11, and we've come to a place where we're getting closer and closer to the culmination of our education. And the culmination is science. Not that science is the culmination to education, but that our education must include science in order to be effective. Because science is an objectivization of consciousness on a universal scale. The form, the objective form of science is the cosmos. And one of the most indelible lessons of civilization is that unless you include the cosmos objectively in the conscious cycle, it's almost inevitable that consciousness will regress. And so today's lecture is about the almost inevitability of regression in consciousness, unless the ecology of consciousness is cinched into stability by including science, including the cosmos, into our consideration. Perhaps the most telling error, the trigger of erroneous procedure in the whole shebang, is that consciousness is not an integrating process. It's not an integrating energy. In fact, consciousness is not an energy. Consciousness is a dynamic, and it's a differentiating dynamic. If you look at the way in which nature works, nature integrates. Nature chooses to have a gravitational quality to the very process of the way in which things work. As soon as you have atoms, because of their nature of particles having clumped together to make atoms clump together to make molecules clump together to make the minerals, the things, the stuff, they clump together to make the planets, the stars, they clump together to make galactic structures, and galactic structures clump together to make clusters of galaxies and superclusters of clusters of galaxies. All of this is characteristic of nature. Consciousness goes exactly in an opposite way. Consciousness never integrates, it always differentiates. It doesn't mean that they're polarities in the sense that they cancel each other out. This is a mistake of the imagination. It's that they're complementarities. And they go together, but they only go together in a balanced way when consciousness is as full as nature. When consciousness has its complete ecology, the ecology of consciousness complements the ecology of nature, and they form a very real paired tandem, like the infinity sign, which is quite real. And that tandem turns out to have a stability in terms of the energy, but also a variety in terms of the dynamic. And that's a state of health. It's very difficult to appreciate, but the prism which makes the cosmos possible, the only object in the whole universe that makes the cosmos possible, is the spiritual person. Our persons. Without that prism, the range of possibility would never be complete in its differentiating form. And what is its differentiating form? its differentiating form is continued openness, openness that opens out further. So that there's a paradox involved in the person. The person as a differential form, unlike the idea of a person as an integral form, actually functions by freedom and variation. Whereas the idea of the person is a mental construct. It's maya, it's illusion. The idea of a person functions by integral definition, which cinches down to an identity which logically can only be stated as a tautology. That is to say, in very simple terms, if your test of something is real is that A equals A, you've already regressed massively and on your way to an ideological position, whether you like it or not or know it or not. The ideological position always results in a state taking precedence over an individual. And we call this, in this country, for the last 300 years, a tyranny. We live in a constant challenge situation now, where almost ultimate tyrannies are just around the corner on almost every aspect of our lives, and we have survived so far not because of our courage, not because of our capacities, but because the, quote, bad guys have not yet been able to figure out just how to do this, but they're very close. There is no way to compare tyrannies of the past with tyrannies of the future. With genetic engineering, with nanotechnology, there's almost no chance that an individual being would be able, short of being a universal yogi, to transcend the corralling effect of genetic engineering and nanotechnology. And that's why an education like this is indispensable for the third millennium, because the next millennium will have to face that challenge in every generation. The next 1,000 years is literally a challenge of every generation to not go that way. And so an education like this is meant to be a pilot light to light that Olympic flame of those spiritual athletes that are coming along, our children and their children and those descendants, to be able to understand that each generation is going to have to light their own torch in their own way and carry it in such a way that their descendants are also going to have some fire to find that they can light their torch in their way in their turn. So this is a very serious endeavor. So by History 11, we've come to the threshold where we realize that an effective education, a really practical education, must include science. And that science is a devastatingly titanic paradox. It can sink us, or it can carry us along to a completion. But that the completion is not an integral completion, but a differential completion. And a differential completion is continued openness, continued freedom, continued variability. In terms of music, a really cosmic artist is someone like Brahms. Brahms, in his composing technique, discovered the principle of developing variation. Mozart was fantastic with variation in a Baroque mode, but Brahms developing variation is almost like an algorithmic possibility that continues to function as you continue to compose and play the piece. One of the legacies of Brahms' technique of developing variation is the jazz riff. the use of complete freedom while performing a piece is characteristic of jazz. And the jazz riff is an example of a very cosmic artistry, a differential individual who is able to explore unknown possibilities on the spur of the moment spontaneously. So given this, we have a very interesting paradox. Science has to do with spontaneity more than it has to do with bureaucracy. And one of the litmus tests of a danger period is when science is characterized more by bureaucracy than by spontaneity. And as you look around today, the late 1997 world, you can see that we're in a danger zone. The needle is way in the red. And it's in the red not because the challenge is on level that we don't have the right rituals or that we don't have the right myths to live by. The fulcrum is that our symbols are reductive and magnetically pull us into a regressive mode without us even knowing about it. And this is the danger. This is the precariousness. And the reason for this lies in a form which we have looked at in our education over the past year and three quarters. Let's just review for just a minute what this form is. The form is what we've called the square of attention. That there is a frame of reference, even the phrase is so popular, a frame of reference. That when we look at a situation, or as Jung would say, persons, situations, things, when we look at this field of possibility of perception, conception, we tend to frame it. We tend to make a square of attention. And that square is a universal geometricity. It holds. If it does not hold, then your perception is not capable of being integrated to the point of a conception. Then ideas are not possible. An animal will see perceptually better than man, but will never be able to transform his perception into a concept. If the regression of a tyrannical state takes charge of human beings, they regress back to this animal-like limitation. One of the most startling of all the revelations of the 1990s is when Eastern Europe was finally freed from 70 years in some places, in other places 50 years, of communist totalitarian rule. It was discovered that whole populations of people simply could not think in terms of freedom and variation. When Germany reclaimed East Germany, it seemed like a fantastic boon. Now, several years later, it's realized that there's a whole generation of about 17 million people that are unable to function on level of differential consciousness. They're used to waiting for someone to tell them what to do. They're used to waiting for a reductive, integral cue sequence, and that sequence lasts only as long as the instructions hold out. Free enterprise in Russia is almost impossible because of the communist state of mind, which was a reductive ideology. In a very peculiar way, the United States also has a reductive ideology that's been in place now for at least two generations. And people are losing the capacity to function in terms of freedom and variability. All of these issues come to a crunch, but one cannot name, one cannot point to the focus of that crunch without running into the very peril that one would like to avoid. That is to say, the whole process of naming and of designating, of identifying, is itself co-opted into the regressive problem. And so one has to develop a very street-smart conscious intelligence. And one of the phrases, I think you've heard this before, that in terms of reality, you can never draw straight lines. You always have to find a way to come to it in a circumambulatory, in an arcing kind of a situation. This is very difficult to understand as long as you are standing on the earth and you're moving on lines of sight. It seems like the straightest point pairing is just to go directly to something. Yet if you're flying from Los Angeles to London, you fly on one of the great arcs of the globe because the earth is round. You don't fly a straight line to London. Any pilot knows that. You follow one of the great arcs. If you're sending a manned mission to Mars, you don't want to send them in a straight line. You want to send them in some kind of arc that goes with the orbits dynamically of the planets vis-a-vis the sun. And not only are the planets moving around the sun, but the whole star system is moving in a galactic range, and the whole galaxy is spinning and moving within a supercluster of galaxies. So that more and more, as you explore the true cosmos, you have to take into consideration more and more factors in the arcing, in this circumambulatory arcing that becomes very complex, because you're not dealing with just one sphere, but you're dealing with a whole series of sphericalities. And the guarantee that you are able to do this is that any kind of a sequence of sphericalities always is both integral and differential at the same time in terms of its harmonic. So if you're going to be good starship pilot, you have to know Pythagorean music. You have to understand that that's the way that movement is real on that scale in that complexity. That's what's practical. And if you're still caught up in the limiting intelligence of drawing straight lines to be practical, of getting out the old ruler and saying, this is the way that things need to be done, one is ignoring the fact that now the simplest activities in life involve such complex sequences of sphericality that it's almost impossible to even draw a straight line, even for one instant, and to have it real or practicable. This is true because while nature integrates and allows for those straight lines to be introduced and operable, and even the process of myth, of language, complex as it is still integrable. Its mode is still integration and still allows for straight lines. They're called plot lines. Beginning, middle, and end. You can still tell a narrative tale and still have it correspond to nature. But there is no way to have a visionary line that corresponds to straight lines. Fairy tales never have plot lines that are beginning, middle, and end. The characteristic of a fairy tale structure, let me quote just for a second from J.R.R. Tolkien, who was one of the best 20th century fairy tale tellers. A fairy tale will always have a twist in the movement of the story sequence, which is startling, which is something completely unexpected, completely new. And usually, that twist is there near what would be the end. So that the end of a fairy tale is a sudden surprise, always. In fact, Tolkien, in his essay on fairy tales, said, so little has this realization permeated the use of English language that the English language itself has no word for a sudden happy ending. We have no word for the sudden happy triumph, the happy apocalypse that comes in a fairy tale structure. He donated a suggestion for a word, and we'll talk about that next week. We don't want to prematurely get into that. But the point that we're getting to is that there are no points. The lesson of this particular aspect of the education is that there are no lessons. But there are a range of possibilities that are likely. And one has to learn to deal with the differential gestalts of a likely range of possibility. That in itself, on a differentiating energy mode, is where accuracy lies. Mars Observer was likened to somebody in Pasadena throwing a baseball through a specific window in the Empire State Building. Our capacity now to be exact in terms of interplanetary travel is phenomenal. Our ability to even plumb the entire star system is phenomenal. Those of you who were in Pasadena in 1989 when Voyager went by Neptune heard very clearly the JPL scientists say, when Voyager was launched, we did not have the technical capacity to contact Voyager 2 beyond the orbit of Saturn. We couldn't have received signals, even when it got to Uranus in 1986, much less Neptune in 1989, much less that fabulous position that came in late 1990, where Voyager turned its cameras back on the star system and took a family portrait for the first time, all of the planets and the sun together, because Pluto was within the orbit of Neptune. Voyager 2 was able to take a family photograph of the entire star system and send it back, and we were able to receive it. We had to learn the technical capacity to keep up with our own progress while we were doing it. That was the lesson of Voyager. And that it was an asymptotic development from Apollo. Apollo sending a man to the moon was a program that was impossible to do when it was announced. We're going to put a man on the moon in this decade. Why? Because we're not going to be swamped by the backwash of history, we're going to ride the wave in all the way. We're going to get to the beach on the other side. Very zen. But Apollo, no matter how brilliant it was, to be able to carry out a projected future program, which required learning on the way, Voyager was asymptotically better than that. Because it required us to learn how to learn. Not just to carry out a plan and find out how to do that, but how to make up plans that never existed before and learn how to do those. And so by 1990, our species had learned how to learn on an exponential, differential conscious way. And that bought us a ticket to the cosmos. We can go anywhere. Not only that we can imagine, but But we could go places that we couldn't even imagine now we can go. We have that navigating cosmic capacity. But as soon as Mother Nature senses that her children have a capacity, she expects us to live that fully. And if we don't, she gets, even subconsciously, the idea that we're shirking our own capacity. You're not living up to your own potential. And she starts to nag. It's like we haven't had anybody scuff around on the moon now for a quarter of a century. And Mother Nature on the moon is getting impatient. Where are the children that said they were coming? Oh, they're playing hooky. Oh, yeah? Time to cause some problems for them. Time to stop their allowance. You think you're in school just to play? No mun, no fun. We don't understand yet that opening up our capacities means that we have accepted the responsibility to play with them. That it's not like there's a gun to our heads, but it's like there's an openness to our heads. The iconography of the conscious person has always been a kind of a nimbus around the head. Or it's reductive Roman iconography of the halo around the head. The halo is actually a closed circle. Whereas the nimbus is not just a circle around the head, but it's a sphere. And it's like if you go through certain contemplative practices, certain prayer disciplines, certain yogas, you acquire that conscious differential dimensionality that you carry with you. Someone who is an Aikido master moves to avoid a threatening move before one even perceives it, before even the person who threw it conceived of sending it. You cannot throw a punch at an Aikido master. You can try all day. You can be as quick as anyone. You cannot do it. It's because this workability, when consciousness is full, it senses itself with nature in its fullness, in an infinity wholeness. I remember being told an archetypally brilliant story, personal story by Manly Hall one time. When he was young, he was such a fantastic, imposing figure, 6'4", 300 pounds, capes, John Barrymore look. And in order to get certain aspects of life right, he would go out into the desert. He'd go out to the Morongo Indians, who didn't care that he looked like Barrymore, who didn't care that he was that big. He was just one of the people who was there. And they taught him how to shoot a bow and arrow. And when he started, because he was such an intellectual, precocious athlete, he would aim at the target and do all the perfect archery things, and they would say, no, we don't shoot that way. You'll starve if you go after game that way. That's nice for target shooting, but not for game, because game are moving, and game are moving in such a way that targets never move. They're moving to elude you. Whereas if you shoot spontaneously from the hip without aiming, with the right synergy of your prey, they will, and the arrow will, meet. That's how you live on level of primordiality. You never shoot the game a la some kind of athletic contest. The shooting of it and the arrow and the game are all part of an ecology of the real that allow you to live. And that's why you thank the game that they cooperated with the reality of your privilege to live. And you make sure that your life is valuable because they have given themselves, they have sacrificed themselves for that, that you may live. On this kind of a level, consciousness and nature are so cinched together that spontaneity is more real than any kind of an ideology. So that what happens, happens with a clarity that is unplanned, yet can be understood to be a part of a cosmic design. With the proviso that you never reduce the cosmic design down to an idea. How do you do that? Because you keep a purity on the ritual level. It's the ritual level that gets most polluted by a regressive ideology. Because it's the body that's the first and the last place where objectivity registers. And if the body is kept pure, if the ritual comportment is kept pure, that is to say, without ideological pretense, it always has a responsiveness to nature. And nature has a very intimate connection with science. Because in that infinity sign wholeness, the next phase from science is nature again. So the cosmos and the universe factor into each other perfectly without leaving anything left over. Whereas when an ideology comes back the other way, in a regressive, reductive way, it comes back and cannot touch nature at all. It comes back in an abstracted way and takes umbrage that nature will not be touched. But what a regressive ideological stance can touch is the existence and levels of bodies. So tyrannies always jail the dissonance. We're going to imprison your bodies. We're going to torture your bodies. And if you mumble once, we're going to kill your bodies. But those threats are meaningless vis-a-vis nature. There's not one damn thing they can do. Because the ideology is based upon a square of attention that is abstracted from nature, has no contact with it, doesn't participate in the natural ecology at all. If it did, it wouldn't be what it is. And so ideologies are squares of attention that are abstracted from nature and are forbidden to mature into consciousness. And so they're in a no man's land, literally. They're in a no person's land. And because they're in a no person's land, the blind spot in them all the time is the person. It's not that they hate the person, it's that they don't see the person, and the person is kind of like a flatted out quality that has to be filled with something. It's not that you're seen as opposition, it's that you're in the way in the sense of structurally not counting. So the true comportment of an ideology to a spiritual person is non-acknowledgement. It's not hate at all. They don't hate you. They non-acknowledge you. And anyone who's participated in Bhagavad Gita spirit warrior engagement knows, you know, in your bones. They not only see you, they don't care to see you. They cannot see you. They cannot acknowledge you. You're not there. Not in an ideological sense, but you're simply not there in a structural sense. So that one knowing that, one understanding that kind of a process, that kind of a structure, the really conscious person can work with that Because those limitations, those regressions, always regress back to the integral mode and always take a universal form. They are always ideational structures. So that they have the power of symbols, but they also have the limitation of symbols. And one can work with that. The square of attention that we're talking about is the square of attention when history has been brought into process, but science has not yet been achieved. And one of the great, quote, non-lesson lessons of civilization is that you can't stop with just getting the historical juices going. You have to continue into a cosmos. But the danger is that you will continue in a regressive way and come up with a cosmology rather than a cosmos. The cosmos is what's real out here as far as you can go. A cosmology is what you conceive is out there in here. And so the danger point is always that you will come to have a taste for a cosmology rather than the cosmos. And it's not as far out, it's not as inconceivable as it sounds. As early as 1946, the great Harvard sociologist David Reisman wrote in the preface to his great volume, The Lonely Crowd, a sociological analysis of the American character. At its moment of great triumph, early 1946, it seemed that the American character was the world savior. Reisman said, this is a severely diseased, reductive character because it is satisfied with the appearance of freedom rather than freedom itself. As long as all the appearances, as long as all the images say you're free, that's enough. You don't go further and make sure that you're free by being free. As long as they tell you that you've met all the specifications, well, then everything's okay. The appearance of freedom is the family on vacation in Disneyland, taking all the rides. And because you can go and you can afford to take the World of Tomorrow ride with the family in the 1950s, therefore the World of Tomorrow is guaranteed that it's safe. Has it been? As John Wayne says, not likely. The devastating thing is that it will never be safe on that level because it's structurally impossible. Not only will it never be safe, it will never be achievable. So that the suspicion of a, quote, middle class American parlor ideology being harmless and good for everyone is actually a very insidious, almost an invidious kind of error. Not because families aren't nice, not because Disneylands are not nice. That misses the whole point. The whole point is that one has been co-opted into a reductive identity which continues in its ideological way and imposes itself upon the ritual comportment of the body. And as long as the body is able to have new thrills, the body ideologically considers that as free. So as long as there are new rides at Magic Mountain, democracy must be safe. Let's just have bigger and better rides. Let's just have blockbuster films that are bigger and better rides. Let's have something new with more pizzazz and then everything is okay. Isn't it? Well, I'm afraid it isn't. That's a disease. That's an illness that civilizations in particular have. The biggest, best new rides with the gladiatorial shows in Rome. And the ruins of the Colosseum are right there. You can go yourself, you can put yourself in there. Did the roar of those crowds do anything at all to improve life? Not one iota. And the legacy of that has been a terrible burden for men and women for a long, long time. Let's come back to that square of attention, then we're going to take a break. When history is brought into play, the square of attention, the kind of structural reality, the rule that happens, is that your square of attention never has any more than four processes at any one time that are together as an operative frame of reference. So if history is brought into play, it means that history and art and vision and symbol are all that are in play in terms of attention. It means that symbols are the baseline, the base side of that square of attention. So that if there's a reductive, regressive activity, instead of history maturing into science, it reduces back to the symbol base. And it's in a reductive symbolism that are the seeds of ideologies, that are the seeds of tyrannies. And especially if the mind has been miseducated in the first place, never matured out of nature, never matured out of ritual, never matured out of myth, in a really integral way in the first place, all of the abstracted habits of the mind get emphasized and become magnified by the regressive direction. And so the ill-prepared mind becomes amplified. And because it didn't learn any respect about the mythological level, it didn't learn that mythic narrative lines and imagination are precious heritages, it seeks to redo them in its own terms. And that's where the myth of the state comes from. That's where the tampered mythologies of tyranny always come from. That's where the manipulations of language always come from. That's where George Orwell's Newspeak comes from. It's a double talk. No one can ever be sure that what you're saying is what you're saying, because every word is ambivalent all the time. And the syntax is always suspicious. And so you end up in a Kafkaesque kind of a carnival. You're never quite sure that anybody's telling you the truth. And you're never sure that your own mind mumbling to you is telling you the truth. You end up with a Cartesian evil genie. Or maybe the voice on Mount Sinai didn't tell the truth. And that reductive oomph, that current, that amplitude of regression cannot be satisfied then with coming back to the mythic level. It has to go someplace where it can register in an objective stability. And the only objective stability in the whole universe that's there is the ritual comportment of the body. So tyrannies always come back to the body. And it's always the body that's crucified. It's always the body that's jailed. And if one looks with spiritually free differentiating eyes at the population of the world today, it's a junkyard surrounded by a prison. And men and women and children are just shuffling around. And they're little prepared exercise scenarios before they're taken back to their cages. Not only will Mother Nature not permit this, but Father Consciousness will never stand for it. So not only is it to change, but it's to change asymptotically. We call that transformation. It's not that someone is drawing a line to challenge the bully. It's one is saying, you don't have to draw lines in a polarity challenge situation. You can alchemically dissolve the whole time-space structure in which the bully exists. That's drawing a line. That's what Crocodile Dundee would have said, right? Now that's drawing a line. Let's take a break. It is very difficult to tell when something is regressive or not, when you get to the level of conscious time-space, unless you become somewhat accomplished at differentiation. To the extent that you carry over the habits of the integral mind, and you have to understand that the mind is always integral, to the extent that you continue to carry over into consciousness the structures that make the mind operative in its own right, to that extent, you will invite a regressive, almost a rebound type of movement. So we face a paradox. The paradox is this. The mind is absolutely essential to integration. And it's essential to the whole ecology of nature. There's no doubt whatsoever that this is the case. This is true. It's structurally sound. And it is also all of those things and more that the mind is participatory in consciousness. But there's no way whatsoever to put symbol and cosmos in the same frame of reference. It is structurally impossible to do that. So that essentially the problem of civilization is that symbol and cosmos never sit at the same table together. And this always is a problem. Always is a problem. It doesn't matter what star system you're in. It doesn't matter what variation of conscious being you are. This is a problem across the galactic foam of conscious space-time. Symbol and cosmos never dine together. That there is an innate, natural, integrative need for them to do so is indisputable. Of course, that's the way the invitations always read, engraved or imagine. They're always hoping that somehow that the mind and the cosmos somehow fit together, and they only fit together in terms of ideologies. You have to reduce the cosmos from reality to an idea of the cosmos to get it to factor into a symbolic frame of reference, that is to say, any kind of a square of attention that includes symbols is going to exclude the reality of the cosmos and replace it by the appearance of the cosmos in an ideational projection. It's a crucial error. And it's not an error that is at all detectable anywhere until one gets to a crisis of history. It's the only place in reality that is detectable. So when history as a differential process becomes more and more mature, this particular problem becomes more and more salient. And in fact, language under this enormous stress and duress bends and twists. And instead of having a narrative line in a mythic sense, where the stories are referential to nature and inclusive of the body and existence in some kind of a natural way, and even the mind and symbols in some kind of a natural ecology. And instead of language becoming visionarily transformed, a magic language like fairy tales, language in this historical crisis becomes apocalyptic. And to a doctor of civilization, as soon as you hear the apocalyptic tone in language, you know that the moment of crisis is there. And there's all the difference in the world, there's all the difference in the universe between an apocalyptic language and a mythic language. And if an apocalyptic language regresses and goes and infuses into a mythological form, once that's done, almost nobody can tell the difference. And the difference between an apocalyptically fevered mythology and a mythology is extremely difficult to differentiate. And there's no place on the integral hierarchy, on the integral order of feeling or perception or intelligence, whatever, even insight, there's no way to tell the difference. That's a very serious problem. Exhibit A. So the book is called Characters and Events of Roman History, From Caesar to Nero. Guglielmo Ferrero was a great professor of his time, Lit D and so forth. He lectured at the Collège de France. He lectured at the Lowell Institute. These are the lectures. Published in 1908. This is an Italian intellectual writing about Roman history in 1908. It's about the time that Mussolini was getting his education. The man had no inclination towards Italian fascism whatsoever. He was a learned, brilliant professor. But it's not enough to be learned and brilliant, because history as a differential process will absolutely swamp you if you're just brilliant and intellectual. You don't have a chance against it. Quotation: those who have read the fourth volume of his great work, The Greatness and Decline of Rome, may perhaps remember how I have described the conservative and traditionalist movement of the first decade of the government of Augustus Caesar. Frightened by the revolution, men's minds had reverted precipitously to the past. A new party, which one might call the traditionalist, had sought to re-establish the old-time order in the state, in customs, in ideas, to combat the corruption of customs. And of this party, Augustus had been the right arm. Indeed, to so great an extent had this party stirred up public spirit and prevailed upon those in power, that in 18 BC it succeeded in passing some great social laws on luxury, on matrimony, on dress. And with these laws, Rome proposed to remake by terrible measures the old, prolific, austere nobility of the aristocratic era. And towards the end, almost at the very end, to hinder the extinction of the great light of Rome in the world, to prolong indefinitely this ideal survival, which is the continuation of its material empire destroyed centuries ago, there is but one way: to renew historic studies of Rome and to maintain intact their universal value, which forms part of common culture. This is what I have tried to do, seeking to lead back to Roman history the many minds estranged from it, distracted by so many cares and anxieties and present questionings, to fulfill a solemn duty to my fatherland and to the grand traditions of Latin culture. If other histories can grow old, it is indeed true, the more needful, exactly because it serves to educate new generations to reanimate Roman history, incorporating it in the new facts constantly discovered by archaeological effort, infusing it with a larger and stronger philosophic spirit, carrying into it the matured experience of the world, which learns not only by studying, but also by living. Now, in retrospect, that's really a broadcast. Almost no one in 1908 would have been able to hear that. And yet it was just one generation away from Mussolini. One maturation cycle away. And the people who heard that as powerful intellectual talk in 1908 are the people who formed the Italian Fascist Party in the late 20s and 30s. Yet there's a way that one can read this kind of thing and say, oh, this is harmless. Or this is important. And in many ways, yes, it is important. But in just as many ways, it's perilous and precarious. The same is true of the rhetoric that one hears politically in 1997. The rhetoric in 1997 is literate, it's intellectual, it's well-versed, it's the fascism of 2020, which is devastating. And the best way to fight it is not to go there, not to go down that goddamn path in the first place. Because the fascism of 2020s leads to a tyranny of the 2030s, which is almost insurmountable for who knows how many hundreds of years. So it's a serious endeavor, and yet one cannot take it in a serious mode. The problem is too serious to be left to the serious. One has to play with it because the differential consciousness maintains its health by play. It's essential to play. I'm wearing a Warner Brothers cartoon tie today. Part of it is that my daughter, who died 4 years ago on this time, worked for Warner Brothers and loved their cartoons and was there as a young director. I'm wearing it in commemoration of her, not in the solemn observance of her murder, but in the happy remembrance of her personality, which loved the gentle, dear adventures of a Bugs Bunny who was able to go into space. That kind of a thing. That kind of a perspective. We have to maintain our ability to play openly with variation in the face of catastrophic, apocalyptic threats. My spirit mother, who was in the London of the 1910s, said the one aspect of Aleister Crowley that he could not dominate was humor, that he was a complete sucker for humor, and at which he would laugh and tell jokes, he would dissolve. And all of his metaphysical, manipulative genius just simply crumpled down into a deflated jokester. He had no defense against humor whatsoever. It can translate down to the little fairy tale vignette of wisdom that when you're in the dark, whistle. Whistling a happy tune in the dark changes it completely. Conscious time space is differential and in no way obeys the laws of integration. In no way whatsoever. The mind in its functioning must be in the integral cycle. The mind cannot play in the differential cycle of consciousness without giving itself over to that. The mind has to surrender to the play of consciousness for it to participate. If the mind does not surrender, eventually the mind has only loaned out this permission and, like some miserly Indian giver, takes it back with interest. And the game is up, the jig is up, the extension of the loan of all of this is up when one comes to that crisis point in the historical process. Because the next wave of exploration, the next resonance of adventure for conscious time-space is truly the unknown. The unknown in terms of space, the future in terms of time, and freedom and variability in terms of consciousness. And so the unknown future of freedom and variability is the natural conscious time-space dimensionality of the next movement of history, and the mind cannot participate in that without surrendering. And a mind that doesn't learn to surrender and give itself up to the play of that and let that spontaneity of reality simply play, simply be, simply occur, the mind then becomes the adversary, becomes adversarial. It initiates an apocalyptic conflict that tugs it all back into a regressive, reductive mode where it then, having been fearful of this possibility, makes sure that it doesn't happen again, ever. And anyone who is able to continue on into that now terrifying, unknown future of freedom and variation is not only heretical, but is downright evil. That's where evil is. Those who want to continue into the unknown future with freedom and variation. Is this fanciful? Hardly. When one reviews the history, especially of the last 5 or 6,000 years of civilization, one sees again and again in its scenarios, in its variables, in its possibilities, one sees this kind of cycling played out so many times over that after several thousand examples of it, you come to see that there's almost like this pattern. It's almost like in chaos theory where the double attractor butterfly pattern occurs out of sheer randomness, but a randomness that cycled hundreds or thousands of times, one will see that in the randomness is a pattern. In the freedom and variability, there is a pattern of infinity that is spontaneously possible, but if it's corralled, if it's brought back in, that infinity collapses back to a circle which is unstable. An ideology is a limited circle of unstable quality. Why? Because it's trying to cram infinity into some form. It's trying to take the baby and put it back in the womb. It will die there. Not only will the baby die, the mother will die. But an ideologue does not believe that, will not believe that, and will not let you believe it either. One of the most important medical Doctor of Civilization diagnoses ever made is Eric Hoffer's The True Believer, his little book that came out in the mid-50s. That the insidious thing is that the fanatic is not only loose everywhere and willing to die for his beliefs, he's willing that you will die for his beliefs also. My friend Dr. Heller says one of his favorite quotes is John Calvin watching his best friend being burnt at the stake to purify the evil out of him. He kept throwing more wood on the fire saying, this is good for you. It'll purify your soul. An ideologue gets trapped in that kind of short-circuited dead-endedness and considers that not dead-ended, but returning back to the old values that are worth dying for. They're worth you dying for because it's good for you to do so. This is the ultimate sacrifice. It's the old mythic certainty that a sacrificial altar should have blood on it. Whereas soon as consciousness gets spiritually born in transformation, understands that there's no altar there to put blood on as a thing. It's a visionary process, and what graces that altar of visionary process is not physiological blood, but the courage of the spirit to explore. And one puts one's courage of spirit on that altar of possibility, and that's the spiritual sacrifice. Has nothing whatsoever to do with your blood or someone else's blood or something's blood on some piece of stone. Has nothing to do with that at all. And if it does, you're sick. It's not that you're sick because you have a false belief, but it's more insidious than that. It's that the whole regressive ecology is in place and its last place of stability is in your body. That's where it comes to rest. And that's why the ideologue becomes so desperately convinced, because they can feel it in their bones that they're right. Because it's in a regressive mode. They don't feel that it's corrupted or dangerous. They feel that it's certain and exact. And they can feel it. And they know it. And they believe and they know for certainty that you, deep down in your bones, know it too. And that's why we're going to get to your bones. Because then you'll be convinced. Then you will know it too. Part of the insidiousness of this is that history, when it regresses, when it goes into a regressive mode, becomes politics. The very first indication that the historical process is being falsely gelled is that it becomes a political agenda, called a political party. And yet, it's almost impossible for a mind still tutored by mythical imagination and by symbolic preference to conceive of any other form of a population of people dealing with a historical process other than by a political party. It becomes a fundamental ideological conviction that indeed the party, the political party, is the only salvation of dealing with this. And it's not a Western predilection. In September 1997, yesterday, 1.2 billion people were represented by a conference in Beijing of the People's Republic Communist Party. And though their membership has ballooned to 48 million, the Chinese Communist Party is extraordinarily different, even though it's like a minuscule sampling from what it was, say, even 12 years ago. and yet still is not capable of making what we would call in conscious time space a rational decision. Even though some of the decisions made yesterday seem startling and promising, they're made on a basis of parte, which is invidious. The right decisions made by the wrong structure eventually co-opt and bring those decisions back into a reductive mode. 12 years ago, the Chinese Communist Party was a party of illiterate peasants. Less than 4% had more than a high school education because it was set up to be a people's peasant party. People who were intellectual, people who got into being able to use ideas on level of historical analysis, were always trying to tamper with the party's historical program. Therefore, they were left out of the party. It was only in the last 12 years that there has been a sea change. And now people beyond a high school education are brought in, and 42% of the 1997 Communist Party have a high school education. But the Communist Party of China, with 48 million people, is an ideational club. It has nothing to do with 1.3 billion human beings who are in fact Chinese and are not communist. They are men and women. They are male and female. That's what they are. They're not non-party members. That's not an accurate characterization of that population. In our own tradition, in our own historical situation, we see constantly the replay of this kind of scenario, this kind of crap. But nowhere is it so conspicuous as in the Greek experience of about 2,400 years ago, which is why it's almost always held up when you get to level of critique where one is dealing with civilization on several thousand year scale. One sees that the crisis was not that Roman empires were made, but that the crisis was because Athenian democracies were made. Because there is a peculiar paradox that happens here. It is very easy to spot tyrannies of the big bosses. It's almost impossible to identify that you are a part of the enemy. The Dodger announcer, Vin Scully, is constantly quoting Pogo, "We have met the enemy and they are us," in speaking of the Dodgers. It's true in a peculiar way of human nature. The last identification of the enemy that we make is ourselves. It comes as almost a devastating shock, as an ultimate cosmic surprise, to look into the mirror and see the bad guy. Because you know you're not the bad guy. Nothing that you intend, nothing that you imagine, nothing that you think is a part of that bad guy scenario, and that it still happens is devastating. That you are still a part of that is a shame beyond even the last resonance of ridicule and the existential plaintive cry is why? How can this be? How can this happen to me despite everything else? And the fatal flaw in that is that consciousness is not a part of the integral cycle at all. No one ever found themselves by integration. You find yourself by differentiation. A super yogi is a master at integration. What you find is shunyata. You find the singularity of absolute zero, empty. That's what you find. If you carry integration to its ultimate, not its penultimate, which is one, but its ultimate, which is zero, that is discoverable to the extent that discovery itself loses its traction. So that what occurs is that nothing occurs. And not to be able to recognize that just because nothing occurred, to think that that means that nothing happened is a fatal flaw of the mind. Again, it's the two-bit yogis who stress the oneness, and they're the main culprits. It's the false teachers who stress that one integrates to a cosmic unity and that that's it. They're the main thieves of integrity. They're the main purveyors of deceit. They're the ones. Because the resonance of the harmonics of the spheres of conscious time-space have a zero-base algorithm in order to make them rational. And if you use a one-base algorithm to make them rational, it always, like a miserly Indian giver, pulls them back into the reductive mind in its ideological conviction. And who's there? Who is at the center of that reductive mind? A mythological god image called the ego, who's ostensibly blameless because just trying to get comfortable, just trying to get safe, just trying to get secure. Yeah. When scratched, those kinds of blood well up. We're doing this to make things right, to return back to values. So it's safe for human beings, safe for women and children, safe for all that. Very, very good words. All employed in a paradoxical cacophony of nonsense. So that the differential opening up beyond the mind is a field not of some kind of imaginative irrationality. That's the way the Greeks formulated it in Aristotle, about 2,400 years ago. That has something to do with the irrationality. And we have to guard against that irrationality so that spiritual freedom becomes very problematical. That's for people who are possessed by transcendent ghostly spirits. Yet it was exactly that theme that we saw in the ritual section of this course that was used for Euripides' last great play, The Bacchae. Euripides, who was exiled from that beautiful Athens at age of 70, near the end of his life, because he had become too poignant. He's getting too close to it. And so in exile, he wrote the Bacchae to show the flimsiness of a rationality that is exclusively based upon an integral ecology of the mind. What lies outside of that is the entire cosmos that is real. And it makes man then some kind of infesting microbe, some kind of a viral negation. And of course, nature takes exception to that. Of course, consciousness absolutely against that. This quality can be summed up in a very interesting kind of comparison, kind of a presentation. And one has to be careful now not to make an idea. Because on this level, with this kind of radioactive infect, reflective capability, any kind of idea is already tinged by it. So one has to learn to think without making ideas. How can you do that? Your consciousness in play as a dimension of time-space will do that. When consciousness is in play as a dimension of time-space, Pythagoras said that that kind of geometry is history. Whereas Aristotle in his Politics denies that that is trustworthy whatsoever. It says there has to be some kind of a political form, some kind of a legal structure, political form that has its identity, and then you have rationality. And the reason for this is that this is how Aristotle learned from the old Plato. Aristotle's Politics, his book on the Constitution of Athens, make very good sense when they're derived from Plato in his old age, the great long dialogue, it's about 300 pages, called The Laws. Plato of the Laws leads intellectually with just a couple of steps to Aristotle's Politics and Aristotle's Constitution of the Athenians. And that leads very easily by one instructional generation to the empire building of Alexander the Great, which was the model for the Roman Empire, which was also the model for the Mauryan Empire in India, of Chandragupta Maurya. Only unbelievably, in India, there was at play an ultimate truthfulness about the integration process called the teachings of the Buddha, which negated the Mauryan Empire in Ashoka's time, the last surviving son of Chandragupta. After all of Chandragupta Maurya's other sons had killed each other off in warfare, the only son that was left was the mulatto, Ashoka. Gets splotchy skin because his mother was Greek. And he had learned from watching his own brothers kill each other off and making a mess of the entire subcontinent of India under the aegis of making it a secure empire, that when Ashoka came into power, he posted the rules of Dharma at the entrances of the subcontinent, disbanded the armies, not just disbanded them, but transformed them into civil service working crews, and they made huge roads across India and lined the roads with shade trees and fruit trees and medicinal herbs and places where men and animals could have rest. And then he let that run, and for 50 years, India ran as a magical land, a fairy tale land. In the West, the competing sons of Alexander the Great were his generals, and the ultimate resolver, the youngest son that finally brought it all together, was not Ashoka, but Augustus Caesar, who learned not Ashoka's lesson that integration ends in zero. He learned the lesson that his uncle, Julius Caesar, said, that there has to be someone in control. Then the world can be at peace. So as soon as there is a universal first person as dictator for life, the princeps, number one, as soon as one is in place, all the numerical order of empire should be rationally in place, as long as you guard against any irrational intrusion in coming in, which is why Augustus commandeered all the prophetic literature in the empire, punishable by death to own any scrap of prophetic literature, because prophetic language was outside of the rational order of the Roman rhetoric of empire. He was the first infallible pope. His language is exactly and ultimately and eternally pure in a rational way, and anyone who talks outside of that is crazy, is a jeopardy to that. And the reason for that religious connotation is that Augustus learned also from his uncle not only to be dictator for life, the number one man, but Augustus Caesar was the first to not only be political dictator, but to be the head of the Roman religion, the Pontifex Maximus. Julius Caesar learned that if you have those two positions and you make those one, then you have the identification which protects itself against any incursion whatsoever, because the Pontifex Maximus is in charge of the larger realms of transcendence, and they're all factored into the oneness of the emperor, of the dictator. As long as you have both those offices together, then you have the handle on the basic identity tautology that's necessary. Then one equals one, A equals A. Whereas Ashoka was able to understand that A equals A is a penultimate polarity, and further integrates and vanishes. And out of the vanishing, what reoccurs is a wholesomeness of simply A. But that this A, rather than being an integral designate of a mythic language, where the A represents something that's ideational confirmable in nature, this new transcendent harmonic A is a presentational, not a representational, reality, not an idea, and continues to be real because it continues to resonate. And by letting it spontaneously continue its concourse of freedom and variability, it joyfully, playfully explores the entire cosmos. But you have to leave it alone. It's like a child playing. It's like a child who's jabbering away in gibberish is learning how to speak at that moment, because the physiological tongue and larynx and everything has to play with gibberish before it can enunciate words. And the baby's gibberish is the necessary prelude to its being able to speak. So that the so-called nonsensical gibberish of the Marx brothers leads to the kind of freedom of very superior conscious time-space. But it has to have that era of play, that era of nonsensicality, seemingly, that time of gibberish. It has to be able to do that. It has to be free to do that, because out of that will come some new language. Not a language which represents known things in an ideological certainty, but a presentational language that explores unknowns, and who knows what will come out. But all of that that will come out will have that resonance of truth. It'll have that harmonic of veracity to it. Not because we make it happen, but because it does. You can look at the hydrogen structure, atomically or molecular hydrogen, and nowhere in that will you find the DNA floor plan of human beings. And yet, we came out of that because of a universal play. And yes, it took so many billions of years, 15 billion years, so what? We came out of the play of that seed. The only alternative is to consider that we are absolute non-real nonsense, in which case we reserve the right to make non-real nonsense a very rational, lovable dimension. It's called same difference. And same difference is a differential way of having certainty, rather than the reductive equation of a tautological short circuit. Human rights are not guaranteed by parties. Human value is not underwritten by ideological, doctrinal certainties, even though they might register in someone's bones. All of that is extraneous. And that it all is extraneous is very fearful to people who count on that as being an arbiter of the real, of being a guide for life, of being an example and model for their words, thoughts, and deeds. In Plato, while the laws was a model for Aristotle's politics, which became a sine qua non of the development of education, of government, and all of it tied to his ethics, the earlier Plato was always Pythagorean. And so, oddly enough, one can look at the works of Plato as a place in Greek thought, the difference between the Republic and the laws, those two dialogues, show us some kind of a time, place, scenario where the thing shifted. Where did it shift in there? It shifted not because of some kind of a tyrant, of some one person, but of a tyranny of democracy. It shifted because of that. Because one of the most fearsome states of all is not the state that some tyrant runs, but it's a tyranny of the people become a mob. A mobocracy is a much more fearful tyranny than is a dictator. A dictator can be reprehensible, but a mobocracy, when it settles into its bureaucratic sort of Indian wrestling stability, becomes almost impossible to deal with. The bad guy in Kafka's castle is not some bad guy, but it's a petrified bureaucracy that cannot be dealt with. More next week. Thank you.